And now it's time for our regular science segment. In life, there are often things we believe, and it may seem to go against the grain in society, but have you ever wondered just how many people you need to get on board to affect social change in opinion? To find out more about this and other science news coming out this week, Rowan Neagle from Radio Adelaide's own Subatomic joins me now. Rowan, welcome to the show.
Hey, where did the other guy go?
The other guy? Oh, I don't know. Somewhere.
That's right.
You're here, you'll do.
Yes, I'm going to bring so much science into this morning. And this one is all about, you know, how do you do the thing that you want to do?
How do you do it? Well, there are so many conversations happening at the moment where we hear, you know, things need to change. People's attitudes need to change. In some cases, they feel like they've been going forever and nothing's really changed. But now it seems there's an actual goal you can work towards.
What do you know? So there's been research that has recently been published in the journal Science, which is all about trying to find the golden number of people you need to convince to make an idea stick.
Love magic numbers.
Numbers is magic. Statistics is magic. If you can somehow get a hold of, you know, how people can converse and maybe implement ideas. I mean, personally, I loved learning about how ideas are like viruses. That's one of like the core things that I like reading about. I mean, you need one person who just gets a new idea. It's like a mutation, and then it starts spreading to people and people and people, and it can be tracked like a virus, and it's really unbelievable. But in this particular research, though, we tried to find the if the idea becomes viral, what is the tipping point? What makes one idea stretched to an entire population? What makes you think it's good manners to, like, you know, drink your water after you've eaten everything? What makes you think, you know, oh, women deserve the right to vote when an idea was generally not accepted at, like, 100 years ago at that time when it was just so foreign and had no...
Or gay marriage.
Or gay marriage as well. It just, like, stretches along through very different ways. And in order to investigate this, researchers decided to play little games in order to test people. So they recruited a bunch of participants and put them in 10 groups, about 20 to 30 people each. And they played a naming game. So each of the participants who were recruited through the internet would be shown an image. And through this image, they had to name it. So you might see a picture of, like, a man's face. And you can say, oh, that's a man. Or you can say, oh, that's a face. Or you could say, oh, that's a person. You know, there's different ways you can name it. And if you both agreed on what to say, you and your partner in this game, you get paid. People will get, like, compensated for getting it correct.
Whoa, but you're not allowed to collude.
You can't collude.
No collusion.
You're literally just putting in a name and pressing enter into this game.
I see.
But if you both get it wrong, you get penalized. You lose out on the money you could be winning. So eventually in these, like, societies, like these micro-societies that these researchers set up of groups of 20 people, they'd all agree on a convention. They'd all agree that the face of a man that's being shown is called a person rather than anything else. And once these became normalized, that's when the researchers really set to the groundwork of messing with people in order to test their experiment, which is another thing. You know, you got the scientists doing the deception, but sometimes it's
they
necessary.
They have to. Yeah. I'd rather it be scientists.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess so.
Most of the time.
Most of the time. It's mostly we don't
like
know what we're going
to
get, but let's try anyway.
Let's give it a go.
Yeah, let's give it a go. So what they did is that they injected a few people on their side, known as confederates, you know, people who are in on the study, and they would persistently try and push a name. So you might have the picture of a man's face and they might be calling it a peacock. And you're just like, what the heck? That's not a peacock. But they keep pushing it. They keep pushing and pushing it. And then eventually...
Suddenly it's in your head.
Yeah. At what point do you have to just agree with it and start calling it a peacock despite everything that's been going on because you're conforming to the social norms or you're changing social norms to conform to like a new idea, even if it's radical or insane? And what they found is that you only need 25% of, like, a persistent minority to keep pushing until it changes.
A quarter of people.
A quarter, of a minimum of a quarter in order to convince. And in some cases, in these experiments, that all it took was that one extra person to make a quarter of these groups.
There you go, the magic tipping point. If you want to start a revolution, cause any sort of great social change or, you know, just change the politics around table manners. You know, I think we all decided that even if you're in a fancy restaurant, you have to eat a hamburger with your hands.
Yeah.
Same goes for pizza. I've had people look at me funny in the past for not using a knife and fork, and I just go, well, do you know what? No. This is pizza. I'm not using a knife and fork. No.
Yeah, just need to get a quarter of the people on inside. Although there is a there is something that does also sort of make it stronger or weaker, depending. And that is the like the measure of someone's memory and how often they use it. So if you have been calling, if you've been eating pizza with your hands for 1,000 years, and you got a group of people, a minority of 25%, that constantly tell you, no, you must eat it with a knife and fork, and then it just harks on and harks on and tries to change the norms.
It's harder.
Yeah. It's harder. It does eventually happen if you press for long enough and hard enough. But
the people who want us to use a knife and fork have to really push it, don't they?
They have to
rise
up
because they're very much in the minority.
Yeah.
So there you are. If you're in the minority and you want to push a new idea, you have to push it.
Of course, this has all horrible implications when it comes to bots. They're like online and social networks. And, you know, if you see the comments section and 25% of...
Don't be pushed online. Is that a good rule?
Try not
for to... For people to remember?
Always read between the
online... Don't develop opinions on the internet. Do it in your day-to-day life with the interactions you have with real humans. Can't stress that enough.
Good, good.
Anyway, now, it turns out that things that disgust us can be neatly fitted into a whole range of tidy, disgusting categories.
Yes.
What can you tell us about these? What sort of things disgust you, Rowan? I want to know.
Brussels sprouts. My mum made this delicious soup.
Sweet.
My mum made this delicious soup the other day, and I was eating it, and I'm like, this is so good. And then I hit a Brussels sprout. She put Brussels sprouts in it because she accidentally bought them. She thought people liked them. Family didn't. And now only she can eat the soup, basically.
I always hear people don't like Brussels sprouts and broccoli. I love those things. They're so sweet. You've got to give them a go. But I know everyone's got their things. Mm. For me, it's tongue fluff, but enough about that.
Tongue fluff.
It's disgusting.
I guess so. But research from Philosophical Transactions, the Royal Society B, basically sent out a survey asking what people find disgusting in an attempt to kind of figure out, like, if there's a different method. Like, why do we find certain things disgusting? And their initial hypothesis was we find things disgusting based on the kind of diseases they bring out. But eventually it turns out that their hypothesis wasn't that. It was based more on behavior. It's based on more ways you can avoid a disease. So the things that they eventually collated was hygiene. So, you know, displays of or physical evidence of unhygienic behavior. You avoid unhygienic people. You think you're probably gross and, you know, the higher likelihood of you having a disease versus, you know, gross animals and insects. It's a very distinct sort of change in behavior. Avoiding someone because they smell a BO versus like seeing a gross and gnarly cockroach is like a very different kind of... It's under the same disgust umbrella, but the behavior used to sort of avoid that and never try and engage with that is very different.
And also, I guess, the perception that you use to pick up the disgust, whether it be smell, sight, or even what you hear... Or even the way, you know, it is to touch something. Does that fit into...
Well, that was part of their initial sort of hypothesis. Like, maybe you'd avoid airborne diseases. Like, if someone coughs, you would have the same kind of disgust as you would around, like, the smell of something rotten. You know, it's got that same level of... it's a pathogen that can pass through the air, so we're probably going to have the same level of disgust. They found that it was the opposite. It was mostly, we have the behaviours that relate to disgust.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you're all kind of on the ballpark that the scientists started out in, but they came up with a different kind of conclusion.
They've overtaken me again.
Yeah, so you got your hygiene, your animals and insects, behaviours to do with sex, so like stuff like promiscuous sexual activities, atypical appearance, which is, you know, when people don't look completely symmetrical.
So got one eye that is above the other one.
Yeah, like a biclops, I guess.
Yeah. Is that what they are?
Like a cyclops has one eye. A biclops would have like an eye and then an eye
and then an eye
above
on top.
It.
That is what I was thinking.
Lesions. So, or lesions.
Yes.
Really. So like just, you know, cuts and bruises and infections are
could
pretty
be
gross.
Infected, yes.
And that's different also to food, which is, you know, if you see rotten food or food with animals in it, it kind of crosses over with animals and insects, but it kind of has its own sort of subcategory.
So for you and Brussels sprouts, is it like the pungent smell? It does have
bitterness,
a very...
like the taste.
Bitterness.
Yeah.
See, it's funny. You say bitter, I would say they're sweet.
Yeah. I guess it's just like you're... one of us must be a super taster or something.
No, just we have maybe different neural connections in our brain. I don't know. We were talking to a neuroscientist earlier in the show, so I've got that on my mind now. Is anything else you can tell us about the study, or does that pretty much wrap up the things that disgust us? I mean, I don't know how long we should...
I do have a bit on like the kinds of questions they ask people. So, because they needed to do the survey to sort of understand what people found most disgusting and sort of lump them into different categories. And some of the things that they mentioned, because there was like an excerpt of the different questions they asked. It actually made me laugh out loud while I was doing this research.
Okay.
One of them was listening to someone sniffle and snort continually. I mean, that can be off-putting I mean, I've been in the position without a tissue, and like it has to happen. So I can understand people in that position. You don't seem to be able to tolerate it, though.
No, I can't tolerate it. And maybe that's... I can tolerate it in myself, no one else.
another question was explicitly, or like saying, watching a woman pick her nose. I don't know why they went with woman, but is that really
anyone,
that
really? Anyone really, I'd say.
All right, how about feeling someone cough into your face?
Cough into the face.
Yeah, cough into your face. That's so gross. Ooh. Like,
well, that just comes down to etiquette or a lack thereof. I mean, if you need to cough, fine. Put your mouth, or even, you know, what I do is I lift up my shirt over my mouth.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not getting the germs on my hand, which I could use to touch things that other people might touch.
Good.
I think that's the most considerate thing.
I just cough into my elbow. That's like, I'm not going to be touching the inside of my elbow and then touching other surfaces.
Hmm.
Maybe wear like one of those medical masks could help a lot as well.
I suppose so. Yeah. But you have to carry it around with you.
On your face. But,
yeah, they seem cumbersome.
Mildly cumbersome.
Now, just to quickly to wrap up with.
Yes.
We have a statement from the American Psychological Association.
Mm.
They've expressed deep concern over US policy. What can you tell us about this statement briefly?
Yeah, because recently you've been hearing in the news about the uproar about the...
child separation.
Yeah, the child separation at the border.
Been hearing that
in the
news
US.
Today.
Yep. And there has been a letter actually published by the American Psychological Association urging the US administration on how there are decades of psychological research that has determined that it is in the best interest of the child and family to keep families together. And they cite a lot of, like, big research saying, like, this is so unhealthy, it induces so much trauma, anxiety, depression. And they also make reference to the Honduran man who, after separation, committed suicide.
Hmm.
And they don't just say there's a problem. They also say the letter recommends that the families do not get separated and that the family should remain together to reduce the psychological harm of the situation during the legal proceedings, which is the big sort of hoo-ha about this, that during the legal prosecution of the illegal immigrants, that they have to separate them during the prosecution, which is the problem.
Yes. Well, we have heard very recently that the president, Donald Trump, may be intervening in the situation to reverse the policy, which is something you don't hear of him doing very often. Mm-hmm. So speaking up about this sort of things seems to be the right way to go. So good on the Psychological Association of America. Thank you, Rowan Neagle. And you can catch Rowan. He is the co-host of Subatomic on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. here on Radio Adelaide.